Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're immersing ourselves in, well, one of the world's most influential literary traditions, Italian literature. It's maybe more misunderstood than people realize.
That's right. And we're drawing heavily on Peter Hainsworth's study on the subject. Our goal today is kind of like solving a historical puzzle.
Okay.
Think about it. Italy, you know, as a single country, it didn't really exist until 1861. For centuries before that, it was this, well, collection of different states, regions, cities.
Right, a patchwork. So the big question, the one we really want to dig into, is how did writers, how did poets manage to create this idea of Italy, this shared culture, long before the politicians and soldiers actually unified the land?
Exactly. How did the language effectively become the nation?
And Hainsworth's core idea seems to be about this constant dialogue, right?
Mm-hmm. Precisely. The story of Italian literature is fundamentally about this continuous, sometimes really fraught dialogue. It's between two massive forces.
Which are?
On one hand, you have the immense weight, but also the inspiration of its past, think classical Rome, the medieval giants. And on the other, the inescapable reality of Italy's political fragmentation, which lasted for ages.
So it's not just a list of famous books. It's more like a masterclass in how culture can stitch people together when politics can't seem to manage it.
Absolutely. This literary history essentially provides the blueprint for modern Italian identity. And understanding that legacy, well, it really helps make sense of Italy today.
So our guide for this is Peter Hainsworth. Tell us a bit about him.
Sure. He's a really distinguished scholar, emeritus professor of Italian at Oxford. His expertise is really rooted in those foundational periods. We're talking medieval, Renaissance.
The big names like Dante, Petrarch.
Exactly. He knows that world inside out. And that deep knowledge of the origins, well, it gives him incredible authority. If you understand how something started, you've got a much better handle on where it ended up.
Makes sense. But what makes his approach so good for, you know, this kind of deep dive?
It's his skill at synthesis. That's what's really key here. He contributed to the very short introduction series, and that takes a rare talent, distilling centuries of really complex, potentially quite intimidating literary history.
Yeah, it can be daunting.
Into a narrative that's clear, intellectually stimulating, but still accessible, you know, even if you're not a specialist. He gives you the why, not just the what, a framework.
Okay, so let's unpack that framework.
Yeah.
What's the central argument of Hainsworth's book? It's not just a big list of authors, right?
No, definitely not an encyclopedia. It's about the forces that shaped the writing. And the core argument is that the whole tradition is defined by that dialogue we mentioned.
Mm.
Italian literature is constantly wrestling, sort of grappling, with its amazing past and its fragmented present.
And this struggle plays out through some recurring themes.
Yes, exactly. Recurring threads that pop up again and again.
Let's outline those. What's the first big one?
Probably the most persistent is the questione della lingua, the language question.
Ah, right. Which Italian should we use?
Precisely. For centuries, writers argued, is it Florentine? Should we stick closer to Latin? What about all the regional dialects? And crucially, this was never just about grammar.
No.
No, it was fundamentally about class, about political power, about who gets to define the national identity. Language was the battleground.
Okay, what's next?
Then you have the burden and gift of the classical and medieval heritage.
The silver spoon and the lead weight, as one quote puts it later.
Exactly that metaphor. Imagine trying to write poetry when Dante and Virgil are your predecessors. It gives you this incredible cultural foundation, this gift, but it also creates immense pressure, the burden to be original, not just imitate.
I can see that. And the third thread?
Deep-seated regionalism. You can't forget that Florence, Naples, Venice, Milan, they were all powerful, independent cultural centers for a long time. They constantly challenged any idea of a single, unified national culture. It wasn't just political fragmentation, it was cultural, too.
Yeah, okay. And the last one.
The tricky role of the writer. Are they this isolated intellectual, standing apart and critiquing society? Or are they a public figure, someone with a responsibility to actually help shape the nation, especially during unification? That tension is always there.
Got it. So with those threads in mind, let's start the journey. Hainsworth mentions that compared to France or England, vernacular literature got off to a bit of a slow start in Italy. Why was that?
Well, two main reasons. First, the sheer prestige of Latin. It was the language of power, religion, serious thought for so long. Second, Political fragmentation meant there wasn't one single royal court or capital driving a unified vernacular standard early on.
But things did eventually get going in the 13th century.
Yes, they did. You start seeing important works.
Yeah.
Like St. Francis of Assisi's Canticle of the Sun. It's religious, yes, but written in an Umbrian dialect, proving the vernacular could handle profound subjects.
And on the secular side?
You get the Sicilian school. Aristocratic poets writing sophisticated poems about courtly love. Now, interestingly, they wrote in Sicilian, but when scribes on the mainland copied these poems, they often Tuscanized them, adapting the language to their own Florentine Tuscan dialect. Kind of accidentally, they pushed Tuscan towards becoming the dominant literary language.
Which leads us straight into the 14th century and the absolute giants, the Three Crowns.
Dante, Petrarch, and Boccaccio. They basically built the foundation the entire tradition rests on. You can't overstate their importance.
Let's start with Dante Alighieri. The Divine Comedy. It's more than just an epic poem, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's a synthesis of medieval knowledge, theology, politics. But the linguistic choice was revolutionary. By writing this massive, ambitious work in his native Florentine Tuscan dialect, Dante essentially made it the premier literary language for Italy. He demonstrated its power and scope.
He basically settled the language question, for poetry at least.
For serious, ambitious literature, yes. Then you have Francesco Petrarca, or Petrarch. He's known as a founder of humanism, that rediscovery of classical texts.
Right.
But his Italian poetry, the Canzoniere, that collection of sonnets and lyrics perfected a certain style. It became this huge European phenomenon known as Petrarchism.
So not just important in Italy.
No, across Europe. It defined refined, introspective, elegant lyric poetry for centuries. Think sonnets about love, internal conflict, beauty. That's largely Petrarch's influence setting the mold.
Wow. Okay, and the Third Crown.
Giovanni Boccaccio. His Decameron did for Italian prose what Dante and Petrarch did for poetry. It established prose fiction as a major form.
What's it like?
It's a collection of stories, often witty, sometimes bawdy, very earthy. It celebrates cleverness, human resilience, life here on earth. A really important counterbalance to Dante's theological focus and Petrarch's high-minded introspection.
So these three, they kind of set the linguistic standard Florentine, but maybe that created its own problems later.
Exactly. They answered the language questions so decisively with such genius that future writers had both a clear path and a massive legacy to deal with. That becomes the challenge for the Renaissance.
Okay, let's jump forward then. The Renaissance arrives. Humanism is rediscovering all these classical texts.
Mm.
How did writers respond to the legacy of the Three Crowns and this influx of classical learning? Did they just imitate?
Well, it was complex. There was a period where Latin actually saw a resurgence because of humanism, but the vernacular came back, enriched. And writers tried to innovate within that established Tuscan framework. Take Machiavelli.
The Prince. Still controversial.
Hugely. And totally new. It's this cold, hard, pragmatic look at how political power really works, completely separated from traditional morality or religion. A real shock to the system.
So political realism on one side. What else was happening?
At the same time, you have Ludovico Ariosto creating maybe the masterpiece of Renaissance artistic fantasy, Orlando Furioso. It's this vast, sprawling, ironic, epic poem mixing chivalry, magic, love, war. It's incredibly intricate and playful, sort of nodding to the epic tradition, but also doing its own thing.
Okay, moving faster now through the 17th and 18th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
What are the key shifts?
The 17th century, the Baroque period, you see very ornate, elaborate styles. Marino is the key poet. But it's also a time of intellectual constraint. Think of the trial of Galileo.
Right, science and the church clashing.
Exactly. Then the 18th century brings a reaction against some of that constraint and ornateness. A key figure is the playwright Carlo Goldoni.
What did he do?
He reformed Italian comedy, moved it away from stock characters and masks towards more realistic situations and psychologically believable characters. You can see him paving the way for later realism in novels and plays.
Which brings us to the 19th century. Big changes happening here. Romanticism and, crucially, the Risorgimento, the movement to actually unify Italy politically.
Yes, and now the literary world faced a very practical challenge, delivering a truly national language, a standard modern Italian, to the nation that was finally being born.
This is where Manzoni comes in, right? Alessandro Manzoni.
He's central. His novel, I Promessi Sposi the Betrothed, it wasn't just a bestseller, it was a conscious, almost political act. He wanted to create a linguistic model for the new Italy.
And that famous phrase about him rinsing his language in the Arno, the river in Florence, what does that mean practically?
It means he took his original manuscript, which had elements of his native Milanese dialect, and painstakingly revised it to conform strictly to contemporary educated Florentine usage. It was a huge effort to create a clear, modern, accessible prose standard that could be used in schools, in government, the language the new nation needed.
He was literally building the linguistic infrastructure for the country.
Wow.
But he had a counterpart, Leopardi.
Giacomo Leopardi. Almost Manzoni's philosophical opposite. Manzoni was engaged, building the nation. Leopardi was this solitary genius writing incredibly beautiful, deeply pessimistic poetry about human suffering, nature's indifference, the vanity of existence.
So the public nation builder versus the isolated philosophical poet.
In a nutshell, yes. Leopardi represents that strand of the Italian writer as the profound, perhaps melancholic, intellectual observer. His lyricism is just sublime, but it offers a very different vision from Manzoni's social project.
Okay, so Italy unifies politically in 1861. Does that solve all the problems?
Not at all. The political unification didn't magically erase centuries of division. The language question shifted from what is Italian to how do we write about this new, deeply divided nation, especially the huge gap between the North and the South.
And that led to?
Verismo, Italian realism. Writers like Giovanni Verga, particularly focusing on Sicily, aim to depict the harsh realities of life, especially for the poor and marginalized. They often used local dialects and captured a sense of fatalism. It was a national literature trying to grapple with its own internal fractures.
That sense of fragmentation seems to carry into the 20th century, too.
Definitely. Modernism across Europe involved a crisis of certainty, and you see that clearly in Italy. Luigi Pirandello is a key figure here, Nobel Prize winner.
Famous for plays like six characters in search of an author.
Exactly. His work constantly explores the conflict between what he called life, messy, chaotic reality, and form, the rigid social masks and roles we adopt. He plays at the boundaries of reality and illusion, reflecting that fragmented modern self.
What about after World War II?
Immediately after the war, you have neorealism. Think of writers like Cesare Pavese. There was a strong moral urge to bear witness, to write directly and honestly about the trauma of war, fascism, and the resistance, often in a stripped-down, unadorned style.
But Italian literature didn't just stay realist.
No, it moved towards experimentation. Italo Calvino is probably the most brilliant example. His career itself maps the journey. He started with neorealist-influenced work, but became famous for his highly imaginative, structurally playful novels like Invisible Cities. He got fascinated by how stories work, the systems behind narrative.
And we should also mention figures dealing with history and testimony.
Absolutely crucial. Primo Levi's unbelievably powerful, clear-eyed accounts of the Holocaust are essential reading. And then Umberto Eco, bridging worlds with novels like The Name of the Rose, huge bestsellers that cleverly mix medieval history, detective stories, and complex postmodern ideas about signs and meaning.
What a journey. Okay, let's pull back and crystallize those key themes Hainsworth highlights.
Right. Theme one has to be that questione della lingua, the language question. It just never went away.
And it wasn't just about grammar books.
Not at all. Hainsworth really drives home that this was the central drama. It was a proxy war for defining Italy itself. Who gets to speak for the nation? Whose language counts? And, you know, you can see echoes today, can't you? Debates about jargon or regional accents or even how language is used online, they're still about power, inclusion, who belongs.
That's a great point. Okay, theme two.
The paradox of fragmentation and unity. The fact that Italy wasn't politically unified for so long was, weirdly, a cultural strength in some ways.
How so?
Instead of one single royal court or capital dominating everything, you had multiple centers, Florence, Venice, Naples, Rome, Milan, competing and innovating. This regional rivalry actually fostered linguistic experimentation and cultural richness. It didn't weaken the tradition, it made it more diverse.
So maybe unity isn't always the only path to strength. Competition, distinctiveness, they can be drivers too.
Exactly. It's a really interesting lesson, maybe applicable to other fields like business or even science, where decentralization can sometimes spark more creativity than top-down control.
And the third key theme.
The really tight, almost inseparable link between art and politics. Italian literature, maybe more than many others, seems constantly engaged with political reality.
We saw that with Manzoni actively building the nation's language.
Yes, and with writers resisting fascism or Verga depicting social inequality or Machiavelli analyzing power, there's this consistent refusal to just retreat into, you know, purely aesthetic concerns. Art is seen as having a role in the public sphere.
Which raises that question about responsibility, doesn't it? What role should creators or intellectuals play in society, especially in difficult times? The Italian tradition offers centuries of different answers to that.
Courtier, critic, prophet, builder, it's all in there.
Hainsworth's book seems full of these really concise, powerful statements that capture these big ideas.
It really is. One of my favorites is the one that captures that founding challenge. Italian literature was born with both a silver spoon and a lead weight in its mouth.
Go on.
The silver spoon of its classical Roman heritage and the lead weight of that same heritage, a past so magnificent it threatened to suffocate all new creation. That perfectly nails the dilemma writers faced for centuries.
That's fantastic. It really captures that burden and gift idea. What's another one?
This one relates directly to nation building. Long before Garibaldi's soldiers created a political state, Italy was first imagined and constructed in the language of its poets and writers.
So the cultural idea came first. The literature was the blueprint.
Precisely. And maybe one more summing up that engagement theme. From Dante to Calvino, Italian writers have consistently refused to separate aesthetic concerns from social and political engagement.
Beauty and relevance, always intertwined. Okay, let's bring this home. How can understanding all this history be useful for us, you know, in our lives today?
Well, first, there's a lesson in managing legacy, that struggle Italian writers had with their huge past. It's a great metaphor for any of us dealing with a strong tradition, whether it's in a family, a company, an institution.
How do you honor the past without being trapped by it? How do you innovate?
Exactly. It's about drawing strength from tradition, but not letting it stifle you. That's a universal challenge.
Okay.
Developing cultural empathy, seriously. If you travel to Italy or work with Italians, understanding why regional differences are so strong, why language and style matter so much, why intellectuals have often played such a public role, it takes you way beyond the stereotypes. You start to grasp the historical roots of the culture.
You see the layers.
You see the layers. And finally, that whole questione della lingua drama. It reminds us that language is always about more than just words. Debates about dialects, official languages, education standards, even workplace jargon, they're always underneath about power, about who's included and who gets to define the terms. That's true everywhere.
So thinking back on our conversation, what was the most surprising thing for you or the biggest takeaway?
For me, it's the sheer stubborn power of that linguistic choice made so early on. Dante picking Florentine, and then centuries later, Manzoni consciously reinforcing it for the modern nation. The idea that language itself could be the most potent unifying force, maybe even more than armies or politics in the long run, that's pretty staggering.
Yeah, language is the ultimate nation builder. And for you, the lasting insight from Hainsworth.
I think it's the idea of a nation's literature as its ongoing autobiography. It's not neat. It's full of contradictions, arguments, different voices. But it's the evolving story of a nation's consciousness. And Italy's story shows that cultural influence often comes from actively wrestling with your history and your internal differences, not from pretending they don't exist. It's dynamic engagement, not isolation.
A powerful thought to end on. Literature as the messy, vital, ongoing story of ourselves. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.